Welcome on the Indie Horror Talk podcast on season two, guys. What's up? What's up, Jackson? What's up, Nick? How's it going?
Hey, it's going good.
I am late tired. I just got done with the D&D campaign last night, and I stayed up all the way up to 12 in the morning.
I don't blame you. Wait, you stayed up till midnight?
It was a very long session, okay? Leave me alone.
I hear you, man. I mean, you're always working most of the time during the week, so you got a break, so I do the same.
Yeah.
So, if to those who are watching this, so if you don't know, this is Nick. Nick, this is the creator and also co-founder of Night Signal Entertainment, if you don't know who they are, but they also created some familiar games and I'm assuming analog VHS horror videos you've made on YouTube as well.
So we made Home Safety Hotline is probably our best known title that we released this year. And then our probably best known short film thus far is The Vanishing of S.S. Willy on YouTube, which is a analog horror short based on Steamboat Willie.
Yes. Right. Well, so since you guys have done so much horror, or at the very least, your main target is horror. What I'm trying to say is what got you into the horror genre in the first place? Were there any key inspirations, films, games, or etc.?
Yeah, I mean, I like most 90s kids, I grew up on a steady diet of Goosebumps in the early days, and so that definitely onboarded me very quickly into loving horror as a genre. I used to constantly look out for the whatever VHS tape of Goosebumps was left over at the old Hollywood video that we live next to, and that instantly made me fall in love with horror as a genre. I'm sure that's a common story for people of our age range.
When it comes to Goosebumps, I hardly talk to anybody nowadays who is a fan of Goosebumps. I'm not gonna lie to you.
Dude, I used to be terrified of Goosebumps, especially the TV show. I would, seeing a clip from it would just scare the crap out of me, even if it was nothing scary. It's just like, I ain't touching that, Oh my god, I think my first exposure to Goosebumps was the Night of the Living Dummy Part 3, I think.
Yeah, it was one of the ones that had
it was just a clip on YouTube, and that alone scared the crap out of me.
There was something really, really weird about that one, because I rewatched it recently for Halloween, and I realized one of the things that probably was really upsetting to me as a kid is actually just some of the stuff that makes it look really cheap now, but for whatever reason, the stuff that makes it look cheap now felt really unsettling as a kid. Like, it added to how creepy it felt.
Yeah.
Where the dummy is just a regular dummy, regular ventriloquist dummy that moves as you expect a ventriloquist dummy to. It looks really unnatural and doesn't really move in a way that feels like it can animate much. And so anytime it needs to get up and walk around, they then cut to a separate costumed person walking around, who's very obviously thicker and than the dummy was. So the dummy just shapeshifts depending on what it needs to do. If it needs to walk, it's suddenly this big thick person shaped dummy, and that just felt so weird as a kid. And now it just makes it look cheap television. But for whatever reason, that low production value stuff added to it feeling uncanny and weird as a kid.
I think that was a common thing used in movies and TV shows. I think, if I remember correctly, I think Child's Play did something similar as well for one shot, but I could be
missing. Yeah, Child's Play, they would occasionally have a short person be Chucky, and they'd do those in really long shots, and so he'd move really naturally in one shot, and then he'd be a puppet in the next, and yeah, I don't know. There's something about that the seams of the you know, effects kind of adding to it. I also noticed in old Goosebumps, whenever they would do this like crappy slow motion thing, that would make my stomach lurch as a kid. Like, I don't know if you remember in like the Haunted Mask episode when the masks would start floating towards her, and they would leave this like this weird like slow motion trail of other frames left behind, and it was this really cheap effect. Like, it's really easy to do, but it's just, it wasn't something I was used to seeing in films, because most of the films we would watch were probably like higher budget and more polished than the Goosebumps television show, and so they wouldn't do something like this, and so it would only appear in the show that we already thought was really creepy, and therefore the effect itself just added to the creepiness. Like, it was like, what the hell am I looking at? Like, why are they moving like that?
It's the little things, man.
Yo, I'm telling you right now, man, people can make anything, like, even if it's low budget, and it still looks good, even if it's funny.
Yeah. Low budget, I think, often adds to horror in a way that it doesn't for other genres. I think it adds to horror and it adds to comedy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I think that was
I was so I was going to ask you, like, because you grew up in the 90s, yeah?
Yes, yeah.
So how was it like for you growing up in the 90s?
I mean, like, the really early 90s stuff, I don't remember a ton of, but, like, the biggest, I guess, 90s-esque memories I have is just the fact that you know, my old computer, the family computer, used to really freak me out, because I just, like, it was just this completely alien thing to me. And we didn't have internet, so it was just basically, like, a vessel for playing a handful of games that we had that also all, like, creeped me out, because they were all kind of, they're all kind of in the adventure game vein, and they always felt very, very unapproachable in a way that the console games didn't feel. So those, like, all early 90s, like, edutainment games had kind of a mysterious quality to them that other games didn't have. like, these are games that are impenetrable. We'll never see the ends of these games.
Yeah, I used to grow up with I want to say edutainment games, but more so just like simple point-and-click adventure games like Putt-Putt or Pajama Sam. I used to grow up with those kinds of games when I was little. But
yep,
yeah, yep. Oh,
we have those
God.
As well. I later found out that those actually were designed by the same people who made a lot of the classic adventure games from that era. Monkey Island and stuff. Like, they're all by the same person. And that makes a lot of sense that they also made all these ones that were in our era of edutainment style games, because I guess that's just where the money went for some of that genre at that time. But it was a weird and foggy era for me, because it was obviously when I was the youngest. But, you know, I remember the landlines, I remember the weird sound that the phone would make when we did hook it up to the internet on occasion, and I wasn't allowed on the internet regardless, so I didn't really understand what that was all for, that, I do remember that. I don't remember anything about Y2K. I remember, I know some people have memories about that who grew up in the 90s, and I don't have any memory. I don't think my family was particularly vocal about their concerns about Y2K, if it was on their mind. Because I don't remember the year 2000 coming by and it being a particularly noteworthy thing, I guess. All I remember about the oncoming year 2000 was a weird, it was an ad I saw for like a re-release of like 101 Dalmatians. It was like, comes out in the year 2000. I just thought that, I remember just thinking that was just a weird sounding year. But other than that, yeah, kind of kind of normal, I guess. I don't know. It was the VHS era for well into the 2000s, so it was, you know, that alone is, I guess, not necessarily a noteworthy aspect of the 90s.
Yeah.
Man, that sounds
cool. I was, me and Safar were born, like, after the 2000, like, or the year 2000. Like, I'm a 2003 baby, and he's, like, what, an 05 baby?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, you're correct.
Oh, yeah. Wow, okay.
Yeah, we're...
Oh, yeah. We're, fair enough.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just so used to assuming that everybody
is... No, it's all right. It's all right. Yeah, no. I was just...
I'm like, you guys know how it goes, you know.
I mean, I do. I did my homework on the stuff, but, yeah.
Well, I think early 2000s childhoods are probably more similar to 90s childhoods than you would think, because we had a lot of similar stuff, and like a lot of stuff was carried over from the 90s into the early 2000s, because it sounds like, you know, you guys had like a lot of the same kind of I guess maybe the VHS stuff is questionable, but I'm assuming did you ever grow up with VHSs?
Yeah, I mean, I used to have, like, a VHS player TV, like, in my room years ago.
Yeah.
And
which I probably had a lot of 90s media on that by default, right?
Yeah, I think we used to have, like, a bunch of old Disney movies there. Mm-hmm.
Hey, same here, man. I used to have, like, Toy Story 1, 2 at the time, I think, and, obviously it wasn't really VHS. My family didn't really have VHSs, but we had DVD players at the time already.
Oh yeah, same here. We also had 2000 movies as well. Mainly SpongeBob. Oh my god, I can't believe that, like, that movie. When did it come out? Like, when did the SpongeBob movie come out? Is it, was it 2004?
I'm gonna look it up
because, like,
as a kid, I would use the school computers to check on the status of the SpongeBob movie constantly because I was so damn excited for it. Now, I remember the very first trailer for that. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I think I did. Like, is it the one with the submarine?
Yeah, it's the one with the submarine clips, and I think it was one of the stranger pieces of advertising I had seen for a movie, considering none of that was, like, it's all like clips from other submarine movies.
Yeah, I was checking the date, but, like, it came out, like, almost 20 years ago, and it's gonna turn 20 on November 19th. Like, we're recording this on November 14th, but, like,
oh, wow. This is,
like, 20 years! 20 years ago! That is a weird...
Wait, you said November 19th?
Yeah, it comes out, like, it came out, like, almost 20 years ago, man.
Oh, dude, it's gonna be a year since we recorded on season one with John Zemanski on the 19th.
Oh my god, I feel bro. Old.
Yeah, man.
Old.
Yeah. Wait,
you're telling me.
Wait, Nick, do you know John Zemanski?
I have not had the pleasure of meeting him, but I do know his work.
Yeah, we interviewed him.
That's right. That's marvelous.
Yeah, it was fun.
Oh, that is amazing.
Yeah.
I still need to play Iron Lung, because I played Dusk, and I love Dusk. And then Iron Lung has been, you know, his big, like it obviously it made a much bigger splash in terms of, like, impact on, like, the horror stuff. And I keep hearing about it, and I still gotta play that one.
Yeah, Iron Lung is the only one I played, but I did talk about this with John at the time. I did tell him I did play the game earlier in 2023 for Iron Lung. Then I played his game, My Friendly Neighborhood, which came out during the summer.
Oh, that's right. It was a collaboration between him and his brother, right?
Evan Zemanski.
Yeah, Evan. Yeah, they kind of have. Yeah, these simultaneous careers buzzing along, because I know Evan's next game is like a Harry Potter PS1 inspired game.
Yeah, it's like a Harry Potter spy game.
Yes, which looks amazing.
Yes.
It's such a big departure from his previous game, and I do love that for him.
it looks so fun and like in a weird Gmod kind of way, you know?
Yes. It's very physics-y, very goofy.
Yes.
And yet very, very faithful in terms of the way it looks to that original PS1 Harry Potter game that a lot of people have nostalgia for. I never actually played it, the original Harry Potter game, but I've seen plenty of it thanks to other people's obsession with it, and I can't believe how well they nailed down that look.
We should probably move on, because we got a buttload more questions. Some of them we can probably group together, but like...
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
All right, so what's your favorite all-time horror game, or like any horror movies you've ever watched growing up? Or
all-time favorite horror movie would probably be David Cronenberg's The Fly remake. If you've ever seen that,
oh, I've heard of it. Yeah,
that one left quite a lasting impact on me since I saw it. I wound up seeing that one in like high school when I first got the chance to see R-rated films. I jumped at the opportunity, and that was one of the films that I had been long interested in seeing, just because the idea of body horror was a really fascinating subject to me. And but that one's my all-time favorite, partially because it just has gotten more important to me over time. Because it's grown from being my favorite movie because of the really gnarly effects and how it makes you feel in terms of, you know, watching the slow transformation of this guy turning into something inhuman and something horrid, to being kind of like simultaneously like one of my favorite like drama films, because it's a really good dramatization of just sort of watching someone you love go through like a debilitating disease, and unfortunately, I've now gotten to experience seeing family members go through similar things like that, and so it hits a little harder now. But simultaneously, is still this amazing, like, gory creature feature. So like it still holds up on like an entertainment level, while still like. Well, like simultaneously delivering this like really potent narrative about watching someone you love like fall apart. And I don't know that. Yeah, it ages like fine wine for me. And so I just keep returning to it. And I don't know. It represents kind of a lot of what I think is great about the horror genre.
Yeah, I agree, man. That's. Yeah.
Very well said.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, I haven't actually seen The Fly. I just know that Jeff Goldblum's in it, and he's been like in a lot of stuff. Like, I think he's gonna be in the new Wicked movie soon. But
oh, is he in that?
Yeah, he plays the Wizard of Oz in that movie.
Oh, well, that's fitting for him.
Yeah.
That's good casting.
Yeah.
Funnily enough. I think he was not really their first choice for The Fly, but he wound up being really, really good in that. His performance in that is definitely one of his best, because all of the all the weird Jeff Goldblum-isms that he does in that movie is just like perfectly suited to this kind of like quirky mad scientist character. And simultaneously makes it even harder to watch him go through what he's going through. Because I think the fact that he is so eccentric and so, like, so quirky and funny, really, it makes it sadder in a way, because you, like, I don't know, than if he was, like, a more serious character. Because, like, I think seeing someone with such a vivid, bright personality undergo that kind of change and the alteration in his personality as well it just becomes more obvious, I think, when he's when he begins this the movie in such a in a weird place. You know, he's in a very distinct place, personality wise. So I think it just kind of solidifies him in that sorry,
You're fine. You're fine. It's
I'm going over my words here, but I think you kind of get what I'm getting at, and with what that, you know, how he comes across that way.
Yeah,
we're always a fan of something.
Yeah. So we have. Thank you for now that we got through your very interesting 90s childhood. Let's talk about, so you're the head of Ninth Signal, correct? Or at the very least, you're a developer there?
Yeah, yeah. I'm one of the co-founders. I'm the creative director at Ninth Signal Entertainment.
Yeah. And what made you want to form the whole, I want to say company, more so group?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just like what, why we... Well, yeah. I mean, the short answer is for tax purposes, and then the long answer is...
Hey, what?
Snow always about them. Snow is always about the game so far.
Bro, ain't no way.
So very, very inspiring story of creating an LLC for tax purposes. But, like...
Well, I appreciate your honesty.
Yeah, no, damn, bro. I wasn't expecting that answer, but oh boy.
Yeah, no. Yeah, we appreciate the honesty.
The secret reason why most companies are started is so that you have a nice safe entity that can take on any of the any debts. Instead of you personally, if the bad times come, and thankfully the bad times have not come, but I recently finished reading a book of somebody who did not do that and was punished for that severely. So that aspect of starting a business is fresh on the mind for that reason. But no, I mean, like, in terms of like. The kind of spirit behind it, and like, you know, why we want to start like a horror company specifically, and because that's kind of what Night Signal Entertainment is. It's meant to be a horror entertainment company, and that's a very specific type of company to make. Is partially due to how things went down with our other company, because David and I we worked for another company that we co-founded together called Deli Interactive, which made a game called We Need to Go Deeper, and then afterwards a game called Camp Canyonwood. And that was kind of more like lighter, like family entertainment stuff. But something that we kind of realized in making those two games, because We Need to Go Deeper did really well, and we all kind of, we're like, all right, cool. So our audience will just, you know, follow us to our next project, no matter what it is, right? And that turned out definitely not to be true. We made a completely different type of game than We Need to Go Deeper after its success, and quickly found out that just because you have an audience does not mean they are going to share your interests as you depart from their, you know, genre of choice. So David and I, in that time, had also just kind of sprung out and made Night Signal, a little short horror game about watching TV at night and finding weird signals that come on at night. And we named the new company after that game because that's kind of the start of our new trajectory into horror. And it's a horror company specifically, mostly to force ourselves into kind of pigeonhole ourselves in a way that will hopefully make our audience more likely to follow us from project to project. Because horror people are down as long as you're still in horror land.
I like the name that you came up with, the company, Night Signal. So how did you come up with the name for that?
Well, it's named after our David and I's first horror game that we made together. So Night Signal
game.
Yeah. So we came up with the name for the game. It's basically a reference to one of the game's mechanics. So in the game, you find signals on your television at night, and you do that by kind of operating the antenna and trying to locate a signal. And at night, they become more obscure and stranger signals. And so I actually had asked around the game development forums on Something Awful to help name that game. And one of the users there landed on Night Signal after a bunch of brainstorming. And I was like, hey, that's a great name. I'm going to use that. Thanks. So technically, that one user over on Something Awful is now responsible for also naming our entire company. So
I hope he gets royalties, though.
After that little brainstorm sesh that we had in their forums, I think they came up with the catchiest title, because I had been calling it Late Night TV up until then.
I mean, that's not a bad title. I mean, it makes sense.
It does. It's not very Googleable, is the issue for that title. Is if you look up Late Night TV, you're going to get a whole lot of just real life late night TV things. And so, yeah, we needed something that would be more Google friendly.
Yeah.
But also... Sorry, go ahead.
No. I was going to ask you. So, like, the game Night Signal come out before you formed Night Signal Entertainment?
It did, yeah.
Okay,
we kind of...
sense.
Yeah, we retroactively... it was, like, originally, like, a solo venture. It was, like, a game I was making mostly by myself, and then I roped David in to do, like, music and sound design stuff for it. And then when we started making Home Safety Hotline together... And that began getting more attention. We realized that we probably shouldn't be doing this under my own name anymore. And so we formed, Night Signal Entertainment, and then just sort of gave the rights to Night Signal Entertainment, because it sort of represented the start of that. So,
like the name,
yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it does work as well for the company as a whole, because it kind of feels like it represents the vibe that we're going for of, like, you know, discovering some unknown thing late at night. It's got that kind of mysterious analog horror vibe that Home Safety Hotline and Night Signal both kind of fit into, and hopefully our future games as well. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, I'm actually this is nice. I actually like hearing your stories that you're sharing with me and Jackson here. This is nice. I used to be not much of a talker, so that's why I wouldn't really have much to put into the conversation myself. So I'm just best for listening. So.
Okay. What he's trying to say is that we're both very introverted people.
Yeah. He said it. So
someone has to say it.
Hey, yeah. It's always better to be honest.
Oh, I feel that. I'm definitely a very introverted person in real life as well. I'm all too happy to, blab about myself when people invite me on. To talk about things we've done, but
no, you're fine.
In real life, I feel you there. I am absolutely terrible at talking.
No, you're good, dude. You've been doing very well so far. Same with Jackson. Could you try to like walk us through like the creative process behind like the vanishing of SS Willy?
Yeah, sure. So our short film. The Vanishing of SS Willy that we released on January 1st of this year was very deliberately made to release that day, because that is the day that Steamboat Willie went public domain. And so that was actually the entire reason for its existence, is that for a couple of years now, I've been trying to figure out something we could do with these recent big properties that had entered the public domain. So like Winnie the Pooh entered the public domain a couple years ago. And so I had been pitching around kind of my inner circles and to David and stuff. You know, we got to do something with this, because somebody's going to do something eventually, and we could be the first to do it. And for a while, I was pitching a Winnie the Pooh horror game. And lo and behold, a Winnie the Pooh horror film had come out shortly after I was pitching that. And I was like, oh, all right, well, we've been beat to the punch. So we're not going to be the first anymore. So the initial wave of press is probably going to move on after that. And so I started looking to what was going to come out in the near future. And I saw that Mickey Mouse was next. I'm like, oh shit. Oh, okay. Well, that's the big one. That one is that's going to be the absolute gold rush moment, is Mickey Mouse is going to public domain next year. So I said, we are not missing this opportunity. We have to do something. I don't care what we do. We just have to do something. And it has to come out the day Mickey Mouse goes into public domain, because it'll be the gold rush. And so we were back and forthing a whole bunch of stuff. We were doing we were talking about a game project that was we were going to maybe work on in between Home Safety Hotline development, but Home Safety Hotline wound up taking up pretty much all of our time, and so we kind of canned the idea of doing a game, and kind of at the last minute, in December, November, I wrote this script for this short horror film that we could do in a reasonable amount of time, that was kind of inspired by an old silent film that my friends had shown us called Haxan, which is this 1920s silent film documentary about witches and witchcraft. And it's this really cool it was really cool to see an old documentary and the way that they were formatted then. And between that and all these kind of classic stories of missing ships throughout the ages, yeah, it just seemed like a fitting way to adapt the Steamboat Willie story would be this kind of analog horror style, but with a 1920s twist, silent documentary. So we wrote that. Made all these creepy photoshops of the different crew members of the SS Willie mangled in horrible ways in a similar ways that they were in the original cartoon, with kind of a realistic take on how that would go down if they were actually being turned into instruments by a mouse.
So essentially, the entirety of Steamboat Willie just happened in universe, and afterwards, that's when SS Willie occurred.
That's our version of the pitch is basically Steamboat Willie exactly as you saw it, but with realistic consequences. sort of recharacterized Mickey as this, as this disturbed individual who, was no longer going to take shit from Captain Pete, and decided to do away with this crew and make them turn them into his instruments for his twisted pleasure.
I'm just thinking about the pig scene in the original short, where he played this one pig feeding her little piglets and just using her. It's just It is so... I'm just... Oh my god. That is just... my mind is very disturbed. I'm sorry.
Looking at it right now. I'm looking at the y'all's channels right now. I'm looking back at the Vanishing. It really looks... Dude, you guys got some good stuff on her.
I think... Yeah, that's like the one thing I recognize from your works. Apologies that I didn't do my homework previously.
You're good, Jackson.
Yeah, I the moment I saw like the SSW, I was like, oh yeah, that was a really cool shorts.
You gotta check their shorts that they made on the channel. I'm looking at it right now on my phone.
I know.
It's awesome.
That short was just, honestly, I don't, as far as I'm aware of, like, the short came out, like, far before any of the horror movies were announced. So this was, like, the first attempt at making a horror-themed Mickey Mouse project.
Yep, I believe Wikipedia calls us the first to actually have a published film about Steamboat Willie that is not made by Disney. So we did mission accomplished. We were the first.
You're probably going to be the only good ones, considering the amount of horror movies being released based off Steamboat Willie.
I have some hopes for one of them. Screamboat is, I think, being made by some of the people behind Terrifier, and that one looks the most promising to me of the ones that have been announced. But I think, I think the problem is that a lot of these adaptations, and I include the Winnie the Pooh one in this grouping, they all kind of just seem to ignore largely the potential of turning these types of things into horror movies and just sort of make Mickey a generic slasher villain. Like, the one that came out most recently, I think, was Mickey's Mousetrap, or I think it just got renamed to Mousetrap.
Yeah.
Where it's just, like, a guy in a Mickey mask goes and kills people with, like, a knife. And it's like, yeah, you're kind of missing out on an opportunity there, right? Like, what's the reason, like, what's the unique selling point of it being Mickey other than it looks like Mickey? Like... I think the best case scenario for a lot of these public domain properties is being actually adapted into horror. And that's what we tried to do with ours. Like, he's still a killer in ours, but
like, he's an actual mouse.
Yeah, he's an actual mouse. So ours is now in a world of animal people, which hasn't really been done in horror as far as I can tell. Like, universes completely populated by animal people is kind of a weird, creepy idea in and of itself. If you like treat that idea realistically, I feel like it's kind of, you know, provides this like uncanny valley history to your world. But also, like, our Mickey kills like Mickey kills, right? Like our killer kills in cartoonish manners. He turns people into instruments. And so, because that's what he does in the original short. So just, you know, adds like an extra flair to the murders, I guess, if you actually kind of use the source material as inspiration. And granted, I think the Winnie the Pooh horror films pay up on that promise a little better in the sequels, from what I understand. Like, I guess two, maybe... Does a little more with the fact that they are, you know, animals that are doing these murders, or like animal people doing these murders. But yeah, I think the reputation of public domain horror equals low effort shit is mostly due to the fact that a lot of these are put together so quickly that they don't really pay much care to, I guess, the opportunity of turning these specific characters into murderers. Like, it's got to be better. It's got to be more than just they look like this character and are a generic murder person. Generic slasher villain is the cheapest and easiest way to do it.
Yeah,
but it's also the least exciting.
Yeah, I think that's like one of the biggest problems, like with these public domain horror movies, for lack of a better word. They the only reason why they're being made, and the only reason why like there's an interest, is because they're just recognizable characters that were originally made to appeal towards a younger demographic, but now are just
Yeah, exactly.
It's like a similar thing with FNAF, Fridays at Freddy's. Like, it's kind of a similar boat, but even then, Freddy's like took an original direction with like the characters and everything else. It's not just, oh, what if Chuck E. Cheese was evil and such, but like the
actual, they come up with their own story and stuff. And yeah, I think they do enough with it, like that it feels like it pays off the premise. It'd be more like if Five Nights at Freddy's, instead of actually being about what if the animatronics came to life, was a guy in a Chuck E. Cheese mask goes and murders people. Like, that's the equivalent. Like that would be, you know what I mean? Because it doesn't pay off on anything that makes Chuck E. Cheese creepy. Chuck E. Cheese is creepy because they're animatronics, but if it was a guy in a mask, then it wouldn't be very creepy, right?
Yeah. So that's
the reason that I'm a little bit hopeful about Screamboat Willie. It's not called Screamboat Willie, but it's called Screamboat, which is the upcoming Steamboat Willie horror film. Because it looks like they at least made him an actual little mouse guy. Like, if you see the trailer that they released recently, he is indeed a little mouse wearing a sailor suit. I'm like, okay.
It's just a little man. He's just a little man with a large knife.
A guy with a large knife. Like, he's still a generic slasher villain. It looks like he's just going to go kill people on the boat. But he's on the boat. He is a mouse. There's at least more going on there that pays off the premise a little better. So I'm hopeful that one has the potential to be at least fun. And they got the guy who plays Art the Clown playing Mickey in that, which, given how expressive he is, makes me hopeful he will bring a really entertaining quality to a Mickey Mouse slasher that the other ones haven't had, because they've just been guys in masks. And this one, it looks like they actually did like a mouse makeup on him, so he looks like a freaky, like, you know, killer Cat in the Hat or something. It's
honestly, picturing it just like this 2-foot-tall anthropomorphic Mickey Mouse character just running around with like a large knife. It's like, good job.
Oh, exactly. That's what you want.
What the fuck?
It looks like a little kid with a knife running around. Yeah, that's what I'm picturing. You just a horror Steamboat Willie, to be honest.
What the fuck?
That at least delivers a little bit on the premise. That's exactly. That there's some fun to be mined from that.
Yeah, it's just so ridiculous. But yeah, honestly, just hearing about it, I'm very intrigued to see what Screamboat does with Steamboat.
I think it's important that all these things are coming out, even if they are bad, because the thing is with like public domain is I think the thing that Disney was like hoping people would be afraid to do is that Disney is very litigious. And even though that Mickey is in the public domain now, there was a lot of fear that they would basically be very lawsuit happy anyway, or that, you know, people trying to use Mickey Mouse in this public domain context would be more heavily scrutinized by lawyers and such, and that they would have to really watch their backs. And so I think it's important that all these things are coming out, because it's basically like, we don't have the freedom to actually utilize the public domain if we're all too scared to use the public domain.
Yeah.
And so all these cheap horror people being brave enough to brave those waters first is I think noteworthy, and they're paving the way for other more interesting things to come to be made out of Mickey down the line.
I just wonder what's going to happen to like the Walt Disney company and all that after all their characters become public domain now.
They'll be forced to create new ones. That's the biggest fear.
No more remakes.
Make something original.
Oh yeah. Well, they benefit greatly from the public domain. Like their whole company is built off the backs of so many public domain stories, like Snow White and Cinderella, and like I mean, just name like half of the Disney library. It's all based on public domain stories. So it's finally their turn to like pay back what they have, you know, drawn upon for years. And they're already being a little bit litigious about it, because that's just how they be, I guess. Because I think this is the reason that Screamboat and Mousetrap don't even invoke Mickey's name, even though Mickey's name is at the beginning of the Steamboat Willie cartoon. So I think it's perfectly fine, or it should be perfectly fine, for people to use Mickey's name. But people are still too scared of actually putting his name in these things. We are as well, as you noticed. From Vanishing of SS Willie, Mickey's name is not used anywhere in the short. He is referred to anonymously as the Cabin Boy.
Yo, we all about to like we all about to pull up to the movie theater and just watch Screamboat when it comes out.
You gotta absolutely. Gotta keep pushing the envelope for that.
Isn't it this January?
I think it is.
Oh man.
Yeah, bro. I'm keeping up with the whole Walt Disney situation after their public domain happened. You know, they probably were shitting bricks, bro.
Oh yeah, I think there was some little conspiracy theories for a while about why that one of the reasons they had changed, the Walt Disney Animation Studios logo to Steamboat Willie, whereas it was something else before that. I forget what it was before that, but they had changed it in recent years to a little clip of Steamboat Willie, and people were like, oh, you know why they did that? They did that because that means they can now trademark that as part of their logo, and now if people try releasing the short, they can go, oh, that's trademark infringement, which does not have an expiration date. They're very clever and they're very sneaky. I think people who are try to release just the short, even though in theory it should be perfectly legal to do so, might be running into troubles based on their little trademark gag there.
And they're probably gonna keep doing it.
Yeah,
unfortunately. Yeah,
I feel bad for the animators though.
Yeah,
why is that?
Anywho.
Huh? Not that it's really relevant to like the topic or anything, but like I know like animators are like they, you know, they're not having jobs anymore right now. What's going on currently?
Oh yes, yeah. I got you. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Hashtag unionize animation. Damn it.
Oh.
Well, now that we've talked a lot about Steamboat Willie, actually we have. There's like, I think like half of these questions all relate to Home Safety Hotline. So I'm just going to group them all to one big old question. Mainly, what made you want to develop the game? What was the inspiration? Or just, yeah, just share.
Sure.
Yeah, just general. Just talk about Home Safety Hotline. that's all I ask.
Insert Home Safety Hotline discussion here. Yeah, absolutely. Sure, absolutely. I guess the quick spiel on Home Safety Hotline, for those unfamiliar with it, is that Home Safety Hotline is a call center horror game about working at a call center for diagnosing household pests and supernatural hazards. So, yeah, the game puts you in the shoes of a call center worker who has to answer incoming calls from concerned homeowners who are basically asking what's inside my home. The gameplay loop is really crazy simple. People just call you up, they tell you what's going on, and you have this sort of database of household hazards, and that is also full of weird, creepy things to peruse at your leisure as you try to answer each of their concerns and send them little data packets of information based on what you think their problem is. And if you're right, they'll never call you back and they'll leave you alone. And if you're wrong, they'll call you back to either complain or leave you a horrifying message of their death, depending on how severe the problem was for them.
Oh, so. that sounds very comfortable. I can see why Safar suggested we have you on the show. That sounds very intense.
Yeah, I like Nick, bro. That's my homie now.
Oh yeah, it's a very simple game, and that's partly why we decided to make it, because it was something that we could put together rather quickly in a time of great financial duress, because our last game we had come out with did not do very well, and so we were kind of in a desperate, like, oh boy, okay, we gotta make another game, and we gotta make it quick. So I had this document on the back burner for a while of a game about a bestiary hotline. So at the time that I had wrote the document, it was just this really simple, like, I don't know, you work for the people who write the bestiary in like a Dungeons and Dragons setting, and peasants call you asking what monster is inside their house, and you send them what monster it is, and it would be this really just basic, yeah, call and answer kind of routine. And then I was trying to think of ways to make that feel a little more, I guess, like more marketable, to put it in a cynical way. And I was getting really into analog horror at the time, and it just felt like a really perfect, like it would be like a perfect blend to put analog horror vibes into this. And it could be this like Windows 95 style thing, which is perfectly in line with the kind of, you know, old technology vibes of analog horror videos. And then, yeah, putting this all in a horror context just added an extra, I think, an extra flavor of danger to it that it didn't have in the more kind of goofy Dungeons and Dragons setting. And so that seemed to make it all click together in a really satisfying way. So that all came together really fast, and development wise, it also meant we could rope in lots of our actor friends who we have met over the years through my wife's various gigs and jobs. She does a lot of acting jobs from all over the map. But one of the more prominent ones that you might have heard of was that she did an acting gig, and then I in turn did an acting gig with her at a local theme park called Evermore Park, which was now infamous thanks to a 4-hour-long Jenny Nicholson video going over its various disasters that had happened over at the park over the years.
Oof.
It was a very poorly managed place. But it was very magical because it was this essentially like D&D LARP theme park where people would come dressed up as like, you know, fantasy characters. And the promise of the park was that it was basically like a real life MMO. You go there and you do quests for, you know, the local wizards and stuff in this really authentic looking medieval village.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
And it was a lot of fun to like participate in and act in and just sort of be a part of this like really like fun creative energy that was there. But it was also terrible in that nobody there really knew how to make this appealing to like a more mass audience. Like it had an audience, and it had a very consistent audience, but it had a very consistent audience of dedicated nerds, which was like maybe like 40 people. And then the rest of the people who went there would go there and be like, what do I do? Like, what is the point of this? Because yeah, role playing, I think, to like the average like Disneyland going family, is just kind of an alien and hostile experience. And so they did not pick up on how this should work and why this is fun. And so the park struggled, and then eventually it shut down. And so a lot of these actors that we met through there, they were just kind of perpetually looking for work. And so we part of the inspiration for putting this project together was also to be able to like finally say, hey, we do have a bunch of voice acting roles now, because most of our games that we had made prior to this had never had voice acting in them. And so people had always been asking, hey, if you ever make a game that needs voice acting, you know, call me up. And so finally we would have a game that would require lots of voice acting, in fact, because the call center premise lent itself really well to that. So anyway, so this game is just sort of a fusion of many, many different things. It's the fusion of trying to find opportunities for people around us who we know, and trying to find a game that we can make quickly, and a game that we at least had, at least going in, we knew that some of our mutual people would be interested in. Like, I mentioned this before the podcast, but Trevor Henderson, you know, notable horror artist, had taken an interest in our work after we made our first horror game together, David and I, Night Signal. That grabbed Trevor Henderson's attention, and he kind of boosted that for us when it came out, and talked about it on his Twitter and such. And so it was kind of more important for us to make something that was sort of in the same genre that would interest the same people that he had attracted our attention towards originally. Sort of a, you know, opportunists at every angle, really.
It shows that people care. So, I mean, I care about this whole project you guys have. So I like it.
Yeah. I mean, I just think it's cool that you guys like managed to get some of the people you've worked with previously to like to help you out with this project.
Oh yeah, and we just love like working with. We're working with actors now too. Like, this reminded me that it's a lot of fun to have vocal performances in your game, because it adds a lot of life and energy to it that our previous games that just didn't have, because we didn't. Yeah, this is just new territory for us. So it was a lot of fun to see how you could add a new dimension to a very simple game by just adding very colorful vocal performances in it. And I know it really made the game stick with people more, because a lot of people will talk about how particular failed calls in Home Safety Hotline have just really stuck with people because of how agonizingly horrible it you can hear things got for the person on the other end of the line, thanks to you getting a question wrong in your little Windows 95 interface. There's something very, I think, kind of isolating about a game that basically sees you with really limited tools to help people in the context you find yourself in. and really horrible consequences for people on the other end.
How do you, okay, how do I ask this? Okay, how do you approach creating like a sense of dread or fear in your work, and whatever do you find most effective in invoking those emotions with the techniques?
I think something that I found works really well for creating horror is just creating implications and then not answering them completely. I think implications are kind of like a perfect balance of giving you enough that your imagination has something to work off of, and then letting your imagination do the rest. And Home Safety Hotline and Night Signal are both kind of filled with moments that try to imply something and then kind of run away before telling you much more. Like I think the entries that gets us the most questions from people, because it sticks with them for this reason, is the whistling fungi entry in Home Safety Hotline, which is an entry about a type of fungus that grows in your home that has these little holes in it, and it makes whistling sounds, and they just sort of grow in your walls and such. And the entry just sort of describes this kind of normal sounding fungus, and talks about how it's pretty much harmless unless you hear them whistling in unison, at which point evacuate your home immediately. And it does not tell you why. It just says that you need to evacuate your home if you ever hear them all whistling in unison. And you know, I think it's something that's simultaneously really good for comedy and horror is that type of hit and run style thing where you just sort of imply that something bad is going to happen, and then you run away before giving any details about that. Yeah, I think you know, people talk about that a lot with horror, like that it's about like the unknown or whatever. But I think it's not quite that simple. It's not just like what you don't know. It's like you have to set up an expectation for the unknown, and then you can leave it to the unknown. So that's our version of fear in the unknown is a lot of stuff like that, where you just sort of tap it and then you leave. So similarly, another one of our entries that frequently gets this moment frequently creates like laughs and kind of weird questions about like what do they mean by that is one of the earlier entries, scarier entries that you come across, talks about when describing this creature's face. It says it has no false face. And that always creates a weird jarring moment for people who read that, because they're like, well, wait, what do they mean by it has no false face? What is a false face? And what does it mean? What does that mean? We're like, you know, we're telling you something that you are supposed to already know what it means, but you don't, and so that creates this weird, this weird jarring like moment where you realize that there's more in store for you than you realize, and a lot of that's just inspired by kind of like real life horror, and how those types of things, how those types of like frightening revelations happen to me all the time in my adulthood, is you know, realizing something very dangerous exists in the world, but nobody has made it, like, not nobody has told you, but like it's being downplayed in front of you kind of actively. Like, you know, the first time that you find out that you're not supposed to mix ammonia and bleach, for example, is kind of like one of those moments for me that in real life is like, oh, that's what a horrifying thing that you can make, you know, essentially a war crime in your home with two common household cleaning products that are like sold next to each other at the eye. You know what I mean? Like these things
we
are
all,
are
we
in
all
close
found out the hard way, one way or another. I hate when that happens, you know. It's just a very common accident, and now I'm banned in 7 countries.
Exactly. I mean, it's not like the most unreasonable thing in the world to think to use those two things together. And they have like warning labels on the back, but I'm like, you know, I feel like no warning label could be big enough to emphasize that you will create poison gas if you combine these two things that are would just be very easy to accidentally combine. Like, you're cleaning your toilet and you ran out of bleach. Oh, I'll just use my other generic household cleaner, which happens to have ammonia in it. And now you've mixed the two, right? Like, I feel like most people don't really treat these things with like great severity, and then it becomes this like, well, yeah, just I don't know. I'm stumbling over myself again.
No, you're good.
I'm trying to kind of put into words. It's this feeling of I think it's this isolating feeling of common sense being what you're. Common sense being things that people just, I guess, won't tell you because you're supposed to already know it. And that type of fear is something that the Home Safety Hotline tries to dig into a lot, is sort of implying that everybody already knows that you're not supposed to, you know, mindlessly throw laundry in your laundry machine because, of course, there might be a laundry gnome in there. Why didn't you check for it? Everybody knows that. Everybody knows you're supposed to check for laundry gnomes before putting your laundry in the laundry machine. Otherwise, you're going to break your laundry machine.
Honestly, I was wondering if you have like an answer for like the frickin' wall shrooms. What exactly happens when they sing in unison? Like, do you actually have something in mind for what happens to someone if they don't leave?
We've had a couple things that we sort of like headcanon, if you will, but I like to continue to be coy about that and not talk about what it is because it's much funnier if it does not have an answer that's solid or if it's left to people's imagination. But we've had a couple things in mind, but nothing's funnier or scarier than just leaving it to people's imaginations. So I will refuse to. I will continue to refuse to elaborate.
Okay, I see how it is. I see. Not giving me your secrets. I see.
Or we can ask this while we're after the recording session. Don't worry.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. I should probably play the game once we get off, though, because I am very intrigued. I'm sorry I haven't played it sooner, okay?
I mean, to be fair, for me, because it's better that I don't know much about it, so like the more I learn, I guess, when I play it.
You haven't played it either?
No, I haven't played it. No, I mean, I've watched videos like Jacksepticeye. I know he's played it. Yeah,
now
man.
Now it's on all consoles, so everybody, no matter what platform you're on, you'll have access to Home Safety Hotline.
Plug.
It's everywhere now. We don't have an excuse now.
W Night Signal Entertainment.
So, now that we got what makes great horror or what makes great dread and fear, in your opinion, what sets apart really great horror from like the rest of the genre? Like, are there any creators, films, games that you believe have redefined or elevated what horror can be in recent years? Or,
yeah, I mean, I'm not much of a gatekeeper for horror in terms of like what separates the great horror from the bad horror, because I kind of just love like pretty much all of it. But I think the quality that I probably hold in higher regard for horror that I like is a horror that's made just very earnestly. Just horror that has a lot of that person put into it. So horror that's very personal, whether it's like personal in the sense that it's like horror that's like created based on like really personal experiences, or just horror that is like inspired by something you really, really like, and that you just like, it's just like a love letter to this like stupid thing that you like. I love those in equal measure. So I think the important ingredient is just kind of just letting yourself bleed into your work to some degree. I saw this on the dumb side of that. I saw recently the film called Frankie Frico, which is just this incredibly stupid love letter to like early like puppet based horror films like Ghoulies and Critters and things like that, where it's just basically an excuse to have a bunch of gags with these goofy looking puppets. And it's a very, very stupid movie, but it knows it's stupid, and it aspires to stupid. So I appreciate that wholeheartedly, and I had a great time with that. And then I also have a great time with much more serious things that, you know, are going for something a little more deep and personal. Like, I'm a big fan of all of Jordan Peele's work. I think he puts a lot of himself into all of his films, and I think he thinks deeply about every moment that goes into every one of his films. And I completely adore all of his work for that reason as well. Yeah. So I think, yeah.
Well, if that's how you feel, then I respect that.
Sorry, two of my dogs are fighting in the background.
I couldn't tell what was that.
Yeah, no, that my dogs are currently fighting. Sorry about that.
No, you're good. But you seem to like a lot of films, though, Nick.
Yes, yeah. I guess I haven't talked about many games yet.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly fine. It's always good to talk about films, too. I mean,
we mainly talk about indie horror games, but, movies are fine as well.
I think it's part of it is that it's easier to see a lot of horror films than play a lot of horror games, mostly because games always require a certain amount of effort and kind of brain power. And so I think whenever I'm like done working for the day, it's much more common that I watch films, just because I feel kind of sapped from game development's kind of intensive. So playing a game afterwards doesn't always feel super relaxing. And so it does tend to be the case that I'll watch I'll open up Tubi or something and find some, you know, dumb film called Toilet Freak or something, and just put that on, and that will be like, yeah, that's a vibe for after work, absolutely.
Is that an actual movie?
No, I was trying to come up with a fake title, but that's pretty close to some of the real shit that I watch.
Oh my god.
I mean, I just watched a film called I just finished watching a film called Street Trash, which absolutely sounds like a made-up movie from that title, which is about a bunch of people who living on the streets who discover this bottle of alcohol that makes them melt when they drink it.
Acid.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't know. Like, it's just, they don't really, like, I was expecting the movie to, like, for that to be the plot of the movie, and for them to, like, try to figure out where, you know, oh, who's poisoning the alcohol to melt the homeless people?
Who's poisoning our water supply?
Oh, that's crazy.
But it just doesn't really, like, it doesn't really matter. Like, the movie just kind of, like, this is like an incidental feature to the movie, that it features this potent acidic liquid that people keep drinking and melting themselves with, because the rest of the movie is about, like, this, it's more like about the politics of the different homeless people that live on this street, and like how one of them is like a murderer and is like murdering others. And I don't know, it's a very weird, semi-aimless movie that just happens to feature moments where, you know, you forget that you're watching a movie about acid that melts people until one of them picks up the bottle again, and you're like, oh yeah, I forgot that that's part of the movie. And then they drink it, and then another horrific melting scene occurs, and then the movie moves on to something else for a while. Yeah. Interesting cinema.
Yo, y'all should watch Ace Ventura. I'm sorry. No. You go ahead.
I was going to say, don't you just hate him when you accidentally drink bottles of acetic acid and he just melts on the floor violently? I hate when that happens, guys. It happens at the most inconvenient of times.
Why does it sound like you've actually drank acid? You drank acid, Jackson?
I mean, haven't we all?
Oh, what? No, not me. Certainly not Nick. Nick, have you drank acid before?
I have not.
Oh, is it just me thing?
Oh, fuck. Yo, y'all should watch Ace Ventura after this, or just watch The Mask or something. Some Jim Carrey films.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, The Mask is really good.
I've watched that one.
Wasn't that based like a comic, though?
Yeah, it was based on a horror comic, actually.
And it was like really freaking violent.
Very, very violent. Apparently, the only reason that that was the original idea was to adapt it as the comic was. Like, and it was going to be this freaky, like a horror film. But the studio, they went back on that because they were like, oh, well, we already have a silly horror film series. We have Nightmare on Elm Street. So we don't want another thing competing with that. So we'll make it a comedy instead.
Didn't they get like, I'm not sure like if Wes Craven was like attached to the project or something. Let me check, because.
Oh yeah, I don't remember if there were any particular names attached to it.
Jim Carrey, Chuck Jim Russell, let me see his film. He directed The Blob and Nightmare 3. So.
Oh, okay. Did he direct the remake of The Blob? Was that him?
Yeah, the 1988 remake. Yeah,
88 remake. Oh, that one's great. Oh, that would have been
yeah.
I do wish I could have seen what that would have looked like, or rather, if at some point somebody has the has the balls to do it, I hope they remake it as a horror film. Because I remember I was out of curiosity. I had read the comic after discovering that fact, and I was sort of like, I was sort of interested in what that original tone was, and I think it would still make a good horror film today.
I mean, yeah,
in a way, it is still kind of a horror film because it is weird and freaky in its own right. Those films. Specifically the really weird sequel that they did, Son of the Mask. Did you ever see that?
I've seen a review of it years ago, and it just looked really bad.
Oh yeah, I saw that in theaters when it came out, and it was one of the most bizarre experiences to see this whole movie of just contorting this poor CGI baby into horrific, horrific looking things.
I just remember the sperm cell scene. I'm not joking. There was an actual scene in the movie of like three mask sperm cells. And I'm not making that up. I'm not even being hyperbolic. That's an actual scene.
This part, I don't know why I blacked that out, but
it's real. Look it up. It's in the movie.
I'm already loving this episode on season two on the Indie Horror Talk podcast, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh my gosh, I have completely.
How did we go from talking about
the mask sperm?
How did we go from home safety hotline to mask sperm?
See, this is like a perfect recreation of the types of talks that go on behind the scenes when we're making games like this. This is exactly the type of mask sperm could easily make its way into a horror thing. So that's perfect. This is exactly what the kind of stuff we should be talking about.
Take notes, game developers. That's your new horror idea.
Oh my god, I'm seeing amazing concept art of the mask sperm, which apparently at one point was going to feature like motion captured faces.
Oh no!
I'm seeing Eddie Murphy as a sperm.
Oh, wait, what?
Like somebody like put in the concept art, like, or at least it looks like Eddie Murphy. I don't know if that's Eddie Murphy or not.
I'm gonna look this up.
Jackson. It's all you, Jackson.
Oh my god, it does! It does! I found a picture of it, and it actually does.
Next thing I know, it's gonna be one of Jackson.
This is very bizarre. I gotta rewatch this film.
Oh my god. Oh my god, you're right. Oh.
This is amazing. I take it back. They don't need to remake anything. This was perfect. They already made a horror movie. It was Son of the Mask. That's when they made it a horror movie.
I'm not gonna
get the right idea with that adaptation.
Oh my god. Oh my god. Oh. I am so sorry, everyone, for derailing this entire conversation.
Yo, this is like the W episode on Indie Horror Talk, you know what I mean, right, Nick? W episode, bro. Most
episode of Indie Horror Talk.
Favorite episode, bro. Favorite episode.
Everyone derails and starts talking about the Son of the Mask.
To all our listeners out there who are going to be listening to this episode, please be sure to support Nick and Night Signal Entertainment and go check out Home Safety Hotline.
Yes, please.
On all platforms.
Don't make the same mistakes we did and look up Son of the Mask concept art.
Thankfully, I'm the only one of the three here that did not look it up. Or I don't know. until I did it after. Which I regret doing.
Oh god. We should probably wrap this up. We just got one more question.
So Nick. Mm-hmm. What do you see for the future of indie horror games and where do you hope to take your own work in the next few years? Looking ahead.
I mean, I think it's a very unpredictable scene, but because people are constantly, constantly figuring out new subgenres inside of indie horror. It's a very, very creative bunch of people, which I admire. I think the most concrete and easy mode prediction I could make is that in a few years, we're going to start seeing more stuff inspired by the PS2 era. And I don't just say that because our next game is inspired by the PS2 era.
But wait, is it actually?
It is. Our next game is called Please Insert Disc, and it's inspired by the PS2 menus, And it is a game that will be about trying to fix your PS2. Essentially. It's not a PS2 in the context of the game. It's a fictional console inspired by it called the Neptune 2. But I do think that as time marches on, that's the one consistent thing that's been very obvious over time is that people always make things inspired by their childhoods. And as time marches on and people, new developers enter the scene who are, you know, younger, their childhoods will get more recent. So we've been seeing a big wave, you know, recently of PS1 inspired horror. That's been kind of the defining feature of this era. And I think obviously it seems obvious, and it is obvious that yeah, PS2 would be next. The PS2 Xbox GameCube era of horror games is next. And with that, I think we're going to see stuff like I don't know. I think we're going to see maybe like very kind of like brown and gray looking third person action game horror. I think that's what we're going to see next. I think that's what will be coming next is a bunch of games about a little third person character running around kind of big creepy environments, probably fusing together, you know, memories of things like Shadow of the Colossus with Silent Hill, with, you know, what was that GameCube game about the guy with the eggs?
Billy Hatcher?
Yeah.
I think that was developed by a Sonic team, actually.
Yeah, whatever you get when you combine Billy Hatcher and the giant egg with foggy memories of PS2 horror games.
Oh, that's a game I want to play. just Billy Hatcher going through Silent Hill. God, I don't want to know what the monsters in that game looks like.
I think these are the kinds of memories that are gonna create the next wave of indie horror games. So it'll be a weird fusion of stuff. I can't say I'll be able to accurately predict exactly what types of games will come out of that, but I think they'll be inspired by that era of games, which is an eclectic bunch of games. So, you know, there'll be stuff all over the map, but there'll be at least one Billy Hatcher and the Giant Egg inspired horror game down the line. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's
yeah. It's almost guaranteed at this point. Again, I'm still trying to figure out how that would work. Is it going to be just Silent Hill meets Billy Hatcher or something? That's what I'm thinking. Just Billy Hatcher was like Silent Hill-esque monsters.
Oh, it could absolutely be it. I've never played Billy Hatcher, so I guess I wouldn't know what that would look like specifically for that one. But I guess we're already kind of in the... In a way, we're kind of already in this era because there's like a bunch of like, you know, nostalgic platformers that have been releasing in the past few years that are in this kind of like that kind of fit in this era. So I'm not sure what particularities of the PS2 era people will pick up on as like unique selling points for new indie games, because I think looking like a PS2 game on its own might not be enough, just because I think it's as the eras march forward, they become they kind of blend together more. Like I think PS1 as a style visually is more distinctive than like PS2 style looking game, but I could be wrong. It might be that I'm not able to see what some indie developers might note as something that, you know, they remember as a distinct quality of that era visually, and they'll be able to pick up on that, and then they'll make that, you know, they'll exaggerate it and they'll make it a little more obvious, and then it will be a more distinctive throwback style. Maybe something like the other thing that came to mind was something in the vein of, do you guys remember that Xbox game, Grabbed by the Ghoulies?
Oh yeah. Didn't Rare make that? Rare after they got acquired by Microsoft.
Microsoft? I don't know if that was after or before. Actually, I think that
I remember it being released on, because I remember it being like associated when Rare was bought by Microsoft. They hadn't released like an original Banjo-Kazooie game in years.
Okay.
Yeah, wait, you said Rare?
Yeah, as in the company.
Oh, wait. They made Sea of Thieves.
Yes.
Oh yeah. I used to always play Sea of Thieves. I love Sea of Thieves.
Oh, you played Sea of Thieves?
Yeah, man. I used to play Sea of Thieves. Yeah.
I am the games we talk about here. So far, I am severely disappointed in you, man.
Damn, bro.
I am severely disappointed you play games like Sea of Thieves and I don't know. What do kids play nowadays? Fortnite?
No, I don't play Fortnite.
Good.
I do not play Fortnite. I actually do not like Fortnite.
Not many people do, but still.
How about you just teach me then? You're like my older brother at this point, so you might as well.
That is still a weird sentence. Don't ever say that ever again. Don't ever say that again. I swear to God.
Okay.
Anywho, I think with that note, that'd be a wrap for this episode.
Yeah, this is actually great.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's thank you for joining us for today's episode. Is there anything you would like to say before we pop off?
Probably just like the basic plug I'll do is if you haven't already, be sure to go and wishlist our next game on Steam, as it helps us tremendously. It's called Please Insert Disc. If you look that up, you can go check out the new trailer for it on the Steam page. And it's a game about it's a horror game about trying to fix your broken console in the early 2000s, and I promise it's more interesting than that sounds. I gotta find a better. Clearly, that's definitely the elevator pitch to go with, since I have to back it up with, and it's more interesting than that sounds. But if you were ever scared of early 2000s video game console menus, then I think you will find a lot to like here. So go wishlist that on Steam.
And be sure to listen to this episode by the time this is out. So thank you, Jackson. Thank you, Nick. It was a pleasure having you guys on today. And we'll see you guys in the next episode.
Bye.